Hey, this is John Party, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, coming at you from Walking the Floor World Headquarters with episode number 164 of your favorite podcast. 164 individual episodes of Walking the Floor. God damn, that's a lot of content for your listening pleasure. Okay, so I don't know what's going on in your world, but there's not really much to report here. Lockdown, staying at home, lockdown, staying at home, lockdown, staying at home. The beaches have, reopened this week in Los Angeles. That's been good. Mother Nature has responded by delivering us some beautiful swell, so that's been really good. And that's about it. It's all a good thing as long as it doesn't lead to a giant reinfection. So fingers crossed, everybody wash your hands, keep your masks on, stay at home. Don't touch people. Don't touch your neighbors, ladies and gentlemen. Come on. You know what to do. You know, I've been taking a little break from all the live stream hoopla because I did 8,000 of them a few weeks ago. But I kind of miss them. Do you miss them? I kind of miss them. I think I might just sort of jump back in and maybe, you know, everybody's scheduling their live streams now and it's getting all official. So I might just do some pirate live streams, just kind of when I feel like it. Just jump onto the old Instagram and just stream away and see what happens. See if anybody tunes in. I've been thinking it'd be fun to do just purely honky-tonk cover set live streams. Let me know if you think that's a good idea. Also, I think I'm going to try switching up the schedule for the podcast because I'm getting a little backlogged right now and I don't like letting them sit around and get dusty. So I might step it up to once a week. Well, I am stepping it up to once a week because I'm putting this one out a week after I put out the Steve Gorman episode. So I have stepped it up to once a week, ladies and gentlemen. Let's see if I can maintain that crazy punishing schedule. Who knows? All right, let's get on over to the sponsors. Do you know that Zounds.com has free shipping on every order with no exceptions and no exclusions, even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10 speaker cabinets, giant synth boards, drum kits, etc., etc.? All that stuff, free shipping. Every order, Zounds.com. Get on over to Zounds.com right now. What are you doing? And while you're doing that, we're going to jump into the interview. You know, John Party is a bit of a rarity in mainstream country music nowadays in that he's a West Coaster. And there just aren't a ton of West Coast country music artists really breaking through the way that he has. And anybody that listens to this podcast knows that I'm a bit of an obsessive when it comes to the Bakersfield sound and old school honky-tonk West Coast country music stuff. So I was so stoked in talking to John to hear that he loves Merle Haggard and Buck Owens and is aware of the history. I always wonder, you know, how much are people nowadays even aware of that history? Because it tends to be a bit overlooked, but he definitely is. And I was even maybe a little more stoked to hear that he's got a punk rock past as well. He went through, you know, listening to a phase of when he was younger, listening to punk rock music. And he talks about how that influences his songwriting and influences keeping his music nowadays high energy. Unfortunately, we didn't have the greatest Wi-Fi connection, which is just, you know, it is what it is. It's the new reality of doing these remote Zoom interviews, but it didn't matter. We had a great talk anyway. So this is the pride of Dixon, California, John Party on Walking the Floor. Smiling,
'cause damn, that girl can fly.
What are you doing to sort of keep yourself busy during this strange time?
I have 40 acres right down the road and I'm clearing land and I want to put cows on it one day, and so there's just a lot of tree and we're gonna plant grass and stuff like that. Sorry,
it sounds like you're keeping a lot busier than I am. I've been doing a lot of live streams, but that sounds a lot harder.
it definitely keeps you busy. I've been doing it, and then you mix in the music and
yeah,
you know, do a little bit of songwriting. There's cooking. There's all kinds of stuff, but like I love doing that kind of stuff and just getting out there and getting out in the country.
I know you grew up in Dixon, California, right?
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me, I'm a California native myself, but I had to look on a map to see exactly where Dixon was. Like it's up by Sacramento, right?
Yeah. No, it's up outside Sacramento, real close to UC Davis. That's a big college a lot of people know about. And went to high school there and just kind of grew up around all the farm towns. And all
right.
And just had friends. And there was no shortage of like manual labor. So you learned.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing. And I wanted to ask you about that. Like, I noticed when I first started touring, I grew up in Southern California. And I noticed when I first started touring and traveling a lot, when people would find out you're from California, they'd be like, oh, whoa, cool, Baywatch, Hollywood, you know, like, but the reality of our state is it's like this gigantic state that like, you know, I'm a California native. I haven't probably been to 90% of it. You know what I mean? It's this huge state. Most of it's rural. And there's the sort of a cultural stereotype of California, but I'm wondering like, how does that sort of relate to where you grow up and like your life experience?
I say most everything I do now, I've learned from California, from just being in agriculture, being in construction, being in music, and just feeling like being outside. That's one of the main things I miss about California. It's just like that weather. I love the Lake Berryessa Mountains up there and just kind of that Napa Valley area, because that's kind of that's close to Dixon. And that was kind of, we go up to hills and we did a lot of hunting out there and just a lot of mountain work. And so stuff like I grew up doing that was like every, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, we're going to do that next summer. Right. You don't think it's going to go away. And when it does, you look back, you're like, man, I did that just for fun and now I can't do it anymore, but you take things for granted that, you know, just go back there now, you know, and, but I'm very proud of where I come from and the mistakes I made and everything that got me to where I am right now. And, a lot of people still don't think that you do anything I did in California. Like it's like, yeah, well, you don't have that in California. It's like, well, there's like this whole thing, like happy cows. It's like, what? Happy cows? What? The cows are always in fields and great pastures where I'm from. What do you mean? There's, you know, because there's so there's bad cattle ranches everywhere else. Awesome.
That's funny. I mean, that's what I mean. It's like it is funny that everybody thinks that it's, you know, California is Hollywood or San Francisco or whatever, but it's just like it's like the whole world in one state. You know, there's like some of everything.
Yeah, and it's like when it's like pasture fed, like when they sell the meat, like, you know, grass fed. I'm like, what else do cows eat? I've always seen cow ranches, I guess. I don't know. It's just funny.
Hey, so, you know, am I right in thinking that there aren't a lot of mainstream country singers coming out of the West Coast nowadays? I mean, I know there's a few. But it's not like, you know, we like in this state, we have this California or you could just say West Coast country music, the Bakersfield sound, Merle Buck, you know, that whole lineage. Even you could throw like the Eagles and whatever, you know, there's a lot of the Topanga Canyon, Laurel Canyon sort of sound, all that sort of thing. But that was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. I've had this conversation with, not name drop or anything, but I talked to Dwight Yoakam about it. I said, man, I was like, you came out of L.A., like, I got a record deal in Los Angeles. And he goes, I know, you know, it's like, you couldn't do that these days. Like I moved to Nashville because that's where it was, you know, that's just how it was. And he was like, you're exactly right. Like what I did was just one, you know, it'd be really, really hard to do right now. And he tells a lot of people that it was just kind of one of the few, probably one of the last. Let's just put it that way, you know?
Well, and he almost didn't make it out of L.A. because when he was trying to get signed, to Nashville labels, they all told him he was too country or too rock and roll or whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, he not only was he maybe one of the last ones, but like he almost didn't even get there, you know?
I think that's a great analogy for California country sound. It's too country and too rock and roll. I think that's what Buck Owens and even Merle. I mean, Merle was maybe was a little less rock and roll, but Merle was just kind of just had that grit, you know. He had the too country thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's just funny, but it's all high energy stuff. That's like most of my songs I want to write are have high energy because I feel like you know that we call the nod factor, just to stomp on your feet. Like that's what I love.
Do you feel like folks in California are aware of the heritage of West Coast country music? Because you know, even though it's called the Bakersfield sound, you know, in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, like it could have been any town up and down from Washington State all the way down to Southern California. Every town had a barn dance. Every town had a bunch of honky tonks. There were country bands, country musicians, country music scenes everywhere. Do you think people still, like here on the West Coast, do you think people kind of understand that?
The best part that I could tell you is they don't, because it's the exact way I learned about the sound, because I didn't know, because there wasn't anything different. This was like what we love. Like we loved country. We loved traditional country. We thought that's what country was. I thought Charlie Robinson was awesome and Chris Knight when I was still in California and Brooks and Dunn and like Alan Jackson, and they may not be necessarily California country, but they love that stuff. That
right.
You don't understand? And I think that's what's cool about the West Coast is like, if you don't realize it, that's even better because, hold on, here come the dogs. It's just a thing. It's that West Coast attitude that you can't just bottle up and be like, here, you're going to be raised on that. And I feel like that's
right.
I learned more about Bakersfield in Nashville because I wasn't like studying. I was like, this is cool. We're high energy. And I was like, when we were playing bars in Northern California, I always said, man, we got to compete with rap. We got to be high. We got to be energetic. We got to get out there and do it. And we want fiddle. And I had a fiddle player and we kept it really country and outlaw at the time. And I felt like that attitude was just what it was, and it wasn't studied. It wasn't like I'm going to be this thing. And I feel like that's the attitude that the West Coast has. And if you know it, maybe you study it a little too hard. You know,
right.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know who said it. Maybe it was Buck said it. Like that West Coast country came out of the barrooms, and Nashville country came out of the churches, which you know I think is. You know, of course, there's some overlap, but I think that's kind of like that boils it down pretty well. Like West Coast country had to be loud. It was like they were playing in these honky tonks for guys that had been working in oil fields all week or whatever, and it was rowdy.
And it was always rowdy. And that's we go back to West Coast. It's like everybody asks, "What's your favorite to play?" And it's not just because I'm from West Coast. It's literally because it's rowdy and they love music. They love country music. I'll never forget this. We played a show in San Diego. I was opening up for Alan Jackson. And when Alan came on, it was like Elvis was there. And not every show was like that. You know, we play a lot of shows. We ended on the West Coast, which kind of normally happens on tours. And I'll never forget how big his smile was. You just feel the energy. And it was that raw country that he loves, you know, and those guys grew up on Merle Haggard and everything in
sure.
Through their music. It's just that connection I'm talking about that you don't know until you go to Nashville, you know?
Right.
You start really studying your craft. And I listened to some of my early college stuff. I'm gonna mail you a CD of the just kind of the stuff I did in Chico, California. We recorded it. And it wasn't like at the time I was writing, but I really was kind of like, this is cool. I'm going to connect it like this. I kind of call it like rock and roll, more rock and roll lyrics than like the here, I'm going to read the lyrics, make sure everything makes sense, and just
where right.
I just kind of throwing it out there. And some
yeah.
sense, some of it connects, some of it didn't. But like, listening back, I know now. But at the time, you know, I didn't know nothing about Nashville writing. But it was
well, that's really interesting that you say that, because that to me is like one of the things that really distinguishes country music from other genres are the lyrics and the stories. They're like story songs, you know. It's not like rock and roll. I feel like has a lot more sort of like esoteric, poetic. You know, you don't really know what the guy's singing about, but it sounds nice. It's like words that buzz and all that sort of thing. Whereas country, it's like it's a story. It lays it out, you know.
Yeah, boy named Sue.
Right. Exactly. Who, you know, I know like some of your influences, you know, of course, like some of the people we've talked about, Buck and Dwight and Merle, whoever, Waylon. But I've noticed in your bio, it also name checked Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, obviously Jerry Lee Lewis, not a West Coaster, but a rowdy motherfucker. And I feel like his country stuff doesn't get its due. You know, everybody thinks of him as like Great Balls of Fire, which is also amazing. Like, I love his rockabilly stuff,
yeah.
But his country stuff was really special. Like, was that one of the guys you grew up listening to?
Those guys came later, but I love Elvis too. Big Elvis fan. And when you're listening, like for me, I was just listening to music. I wasn't studying. I was trying to just listen and find new, you know. And when I found Elvis, I remember really getting Elvis. I went and watched. YouTube just came out, and he was starting to have, you know, old performances come on. And I just started watching him. I was like, dang, he was awesome. And then you start going to Jerry Lee Lewis, and you always grew up hearing these songs. Like, hell, me and my grandma used to sing Great Balls of Fire and even, you know, Johnny B. Goode. And she kind of loved that 50s music that, you know, I yeah. can't remember when I first heard it, because I was listening it really young. I really can't
sure.
tell you. I remember the first time. Who knows what my grandma played me, but it's just that boogie woogie. It's the
yeah.
boogie, man. I mean, and
yeah.
if I always said, if I could learn to play the piano, I want to learn boogie woogie. You know, fast.
Oh, yeah.
Even Little Richard, like, Good Golly, Miss Molly. It's
sure.
a burner, dude. I mean, come
yeah, well, yeah.
You haven't heard it, man. Good Golly, Miss Molly. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, it's music that you cannot stand still to. You know what I mean? Just, it's impossible. And it's so closely related to the honky tonk of that era. You know, I mean, there's a lot of the same musicians involved, and, you know, rockabilly was like, for the most part, kind of a Southern, art form of that time. So it was like guys, you know, it's a mishmash. It's like they're all kind of connected, but they're very close. I mean, that was really, for me, my introduction to country music came through rockabilly and through rock and roll. It was like listening to the Stones. You do, like, you know, Honky Tonk Woman or something like that. It was the first thing that those were the first things that I heard, and Elvis and Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent and all that sort of, that's what led me ultimately to, you know, to the Buck Owens of the world. So I think they're right there, you know?
Oh yeah. And Jerry Lee Lewis, when he's like, he's got You Win Again, Crazy Arms, and just a lot of that.
Oh stuff. Yeah.
It was like when he was, you know, the heyday of his first sound coming out, of course he was going to go to more country, because it's right in his piano scale and like right in that universe of what he started with. But so yeah, no, that it's almost like we go back to the too much country and too much rock and roll thing, you know.
totally.
You always tried to say, and it's like I called it traditional rock and roll, to where it's that kind of barroom sound from the 50s, and then rock and roll always. Just, it's so much more, you know, like country changes, but rock and roll changes like in all, like, it's just so much, especially these days.
I feel like people lament, like, oh, country music doesn't sound like country music anymore, and that whole thing. But it's the exact same thing in rock. It's like, if you listen to, you know, a country record from 1958, yeah, there's a huge evolution to a country record in 2020. But if you listen to a rock and roll record in 1958, it's same difference. It's to a rock and roll record now, it's just as much of like a, wait, what? This came from that? How the fuck did that happen, you know?
For sure. No, and it's just, we all explore different sounds, and we all love bringing something new to something old and making that be new again. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
The top documentary, they kind of
talk. Oh, so good. So good. Didn't that just, that just made me want to pick my guitar up, man, watching that thing. I was just like, oh, where's my guitar? I need my guitar.
Oh, yeah. Coming up with some monster blues rock and roll riff that had country.
Nasty. Nasty. Talk about the boogie woogie, man. That band had the fucking boogie woogie. That is for sure.
Yeah. And swag.
Yeah.
I forget that it had the green cover. That wasn't my, I think it was like a second album. That was,
oh, is it Tres Hombres?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a van CD right there.
Yeah.
Rolling down with the band in the van, listening to ZZ Top.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned your grandma playing music. Like what was your family musical? Like what sort of got you into, you know, anybody that's a musician tends to be like a music obsessive. What led you down that path?
Just my grandmother. She loved music, and she babysitted me a lot when my parents were at work, and she loved to sing, but it wasn't like singing. It was like karaoke singing, bar, get up and sing a song. And she loved everything from Waylon and Merle. It's all, everything 90s country. Like, I still got some of her tapes. I'll go back and, like, you know, Joe Diffie just passed, and it was like a big bummer to the country, but I went and found the tapes that my grandma showed me back in the day. And I was like, you know, kind of gave him a shout out. I've been listening to Joe for a long time. And she loved Frank Sinatra. She'd always sing New York, New York to me and stuff. But she wasn't ever a great singer, but she was an entertainer. And so
right,
she would just sing, and we sing together. And she kind of taught me how to, you know, I just remember her doing the, she was a fun grandma. Teaching me how to do the duck walk with Chuck Berry and the guitar, you know, like.
Nice. Stuff
like that. So she had a lot of, she wasn't a musician, but she had great taste in music. Let's put it that way. She always had good music for me to listen to.
So when did you start actually playing and singing?
12.
Okay.
I started playing and singing about 9, but it wasn't anything to write home about, you know?
Right.
But 12, I started writing songs. In 14, I was a freshman in high school. I had a band where that was kind of the start of learning the Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Smoke on the Water. And we learned to play Boys Are Back in the Boys Are Back in Town.
Oh, yeah. Thin Lizzy.
I look back, it's like, that was a really cool cover song to be in high school, just like da 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 da,
boom, boom. Oh yeah,
it was just like stuff we used to cover, and then you know, we mix in the country. But at the time, I kind of rebelled from country because I just grew up just everything country, everything
right,
country, everything Allen, and like Blink-182 and Green Day and all that stuff was huge at the time. So I got really into that kind of high energy, super catchy stuff.
Yeah.
And then I kind of burned out after high school. And I was like, but I always talk about this. I'm kind of open about that because when I started writing country again, you know, I have like songs I wrote that always sound country through this whole wannabe pop punk stuff. It still had a, you know, I still sound a country, but it forced me to really dig into high energy, catchy riffs and just kind of always trying to be fast, loud, and bringing that back to country, not knowing that that was even a West Coast thing. You know, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
I didn't know that being compared, like when I moved to Nashville, I had these melodies. It's like, that's like a Green Day melody, but it's country. Like, it's really country. That would even be something that I could look back and be like, well, it's probably because of that phase of my life. But,
right. That's interesting. So have people picked up on that in your writing?
Yeah, in the early days, yeah. I mean, we kind of now have our nickname as Turbo Tonk. We called it punk tree. You know, we had a song called Write You a Song on my first record that we played a lot. Sure. And it was just in your face, you know, drinking with me in the early days. And even me and Jack on Heart of Medication, it's really, you know, you listen to Tie One On. It's just full speed ahead. And because I love that stuff, man. And it goes back to Jerry Lee Lewis. It goes back to Elvis. It goes back to all those guys, you know, and it's just kind of where I came from. And like I said, I wasn't studying. I was just having fun.
Sure.
But that's the environment I was in. It wasn't in like learning those things and writing my early stuff and going to Nashville. That's just where I came from and what I was doing.
So what like timeline wise, what was this like college? I know you went to college in Chico. Was that like when you started really kind of focusing on your country songwriting?
No, I mean, my country songwriting was about 12 to, I mean, even during the pop punk phase, I was writing country songs. Yeah. Secretly, you know, secretly, right. Trying to be all, I don't write. I'm glad I went through that phase. I really am. And I tell it to people that, like, everybody goes through phases when they don't, you know, when they're in their high school. That's what you're supposed to do.
Sure. Well, it's interesting, you know. I mean, I played in a punk rock band before I was in Foo Fighters. You know, I was in a band called No Use for a Name that was from Sunnyvale, Mountain View area up there. I lived in San Francisco at the time, and we used to play all over. And some of those like rural shows out in the burbs were the wildest ones.
And yeah.
Those could be like, you know, some broke ass VFW hall in the middle of nowhere, and it'd be jammed up with kids going absolutely mental.
Yeah, man, it was a crazy scene over there. I mean, we were from a place that there was a band called Papa Roach that came out of Vacaville, and they
sure, kind
of
yeah.
And that was, I mean, I went to high school 1999 to 2003. And that was all kind of in that where, I mean, when Blink-182 came out, it's like, what is this sound? And you got, I mean, it was underground to that. And then, and we love the Foo Fighters too. You guys went, I mean, through it all were just your own rock and roll brand, which is always cool. We always jammed out to that stuff too. But it was just crazy, a crazy time for music. And that scene at the time was huge. And then, my friends were in like hardcore, like, I mean, Zayo was a huge band, and like, and I was like, well, I couldn't get into that. I was like, I don't know what this is.
That's classic.
I had a PA system, so I go run sound for these like crazy hardcore bands. I'm like, this is just nuts. But it was California.
So when did it become something that you knew you wanted to really like make this your life? You know, when did you know, like, I want to go try to, you know, make it as a pro?
18.
Oh, really? So before college?
Yeah. Yeah. I started writing songs again when I was real right after high school, and, you know, Grandma got real sick, and she hated all the punk songs and all the punk phase. She hated it, and she always, "Oh, you need to go back to sing country again, Jonathan." She said it.
So did you always have it in mind that you were going to move out to Nashville? Was that sort of always like, I got to get through school, and that's my goal?
Yeah. Well, It kind of changed around, but it happened very rapidly when I was like, all right, I'm going to go to Nashville. I took my first trip out when I was about 19 in Nashville, and our late 18 years, I was late into 18 going on 19. And I went to the bars, but it's like, it was so hard to get into bars. You know, we couldn't see the music. And so I was like, well, maybe it's not time to go to Nashville, because I wasn't going to go to college out there. I didn't even think about going to college in Nashville.
Did you move out there and try to, were you saying you tried to get gigs like down on Broadway, that sort of thing?
No, I just went and visited.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was like, for that was like I think it was just graduation present or something to go see Nashville. And then I went a couple times after that. I think I went 3 times at like 20 and I've met some people, you know, like trying to, and back then it was way different. Like I was like at writer's rounds at the Holiday Inn trying to get up and sing a song
right.
that I wrote in California. And it wasn't great. So I was like, well, I decided that I was going to move when I was 21. And that, since that decision, I went to college at Butte, a junior college, and I started a country band just because I was more focused on music than anything. And I found a
What were you going to college for?
Shoot, I was just trying to get whatever. I think general education at the time, like honky tonk.
Right.
You know, just right. trying to get
did that. I'm a honky tonk degree.
You know, party. Chico State's got dollar beer nights every night. It's perfect for a band. So I met a mandolin player and a great bass player and drummer and fiddle player. And the mandolin player taught me a lot about bluegrass and minor chords and how, you know, and then we just kind of learned music together and we played a lot of shows. From 19 to about 21 at my age. And I think that was from like 2004 to 2007. I don't know. It's hard to look back, man. But I moved to Nashville. Right. The band kind of, everybody that graduated college and everybody was like going their own ways and nobody really wanted to do it serious except me. You know, I felt like I could do it. And I was at that time extremely confident, you know, I'm going to go. And so I left when I was 22 in 2008.
And so I read a great quote that said you, when you moved to Nashville, you took your dog and like $7,000 and your PA system. Like, yeah. Why the PA system? We're like, they might need this out there.
Hey, we were playing, there was no sound guy. We didn't know bars came with sound guys and had their own, you know, we set up on the floor. We played bars that
right.
were loud bands, but they'd let us come play. So we had to pack everything in.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe that's how Nashville is. I still got that PA system. And I think the only time I set it up for was a friend's wedding. Never used that thing.
Nice.
But at the time, I just thought, well, you know, if they need a PA system, I got one. No excuses, right?
Hey, it could be the difference between getting the gig and not getting the gig. Yeah, that's smart. I like it.
That's just and
you first got work out there as a songwriter, right? Were you working on Music Row?
Well, I was working as a lifeguard. I landed a cool gig as a lifeguard at a private school. And that was like kind of help pay the bills. And I was playing. I loved this bar. When I first moved to town, I found my bar. I was like, I found it. This is just like where I'm from back home. Losers. It was my favorite bar. It reminded me of my place. It's got wood on the walls, a neon sign, a country music plays all the time. I was like, this is my spot. So I ended up kind of getting in with the guys that were playing at the time. And kept getting up, and then pretty soon they called me to come play weekends or as a fill-in guy. And I did that for a year and a half. And then through Losers, met songwriters and, you know, got some co-writes and learned the Nashville ways of writing. And then landed a little publishing deal in about 2010.
Okay.
No, it was 2009. I take that back. 2009, I landed a little publishing deal. From 2009 to 2011, I ended up getting a record deal on 2011.
So, coming out of the songwriting world, when you finally got your deal as a solo artist, did that mean that you had sort of a greater, you know, greater control, creative control over like song choices and that sort of thing, instead of like get songs fed to you from other writers where you're like, no, I got this big batch of songs that I'm bringing to the table and this is where we're starting.
Man, I'm blessed to have a very awesome creative space label of Universal Records. And at the time it was EMG and Capitol. But they always said, we love what you're doing. You go right what you're doing. We don't want to hear anything else from outside. We love this. This is what you need to focus on. And it really helped me. They gave me confidence in to be like, yeah, this is my songs. Even if at the time, you know, this stuff wasn't like booming, you know. And when I came out, Florida Georgia Line blew up. And that kind of, it changed everything. It changed the whole format. And you couldn't help but, you know, listen to it and like it. Of course, Cruise got played like crazy, but it kind of changed everything. But I still hung around. I still got top 40. I never got a number one with that record, but you still see me kind of working, developing to where in 2015 I wrote Head Over Boots. After that, it was still country, but still had a little bit of the more modern mix to it. But it was all because my label never forced me to do anything different. They never told me like, hey, this isn't going to work. They always said it's a marathon, not a race. And to look back now and see what we've done together as a team, it's really cool because there was never like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. They just said, kept riding. You know? Yeah. The biggest battle with my record label was wearing the cowboy hat, but I won that one.
Oh, really? Yeah. Were they pro cowboy hat or anti cowboy hat?
Anti at the time. I had the long shaggy hair, and that was cool. And I still felt naked on stage. Like I didn't feel, because back growing up, it was like always cowboy hat. And like my dad would always make fun of me. You know, like it just never lined up. You know.
Do you think now the sound, the evolution of mainstream country music is welcoming a little bit more traditional sounding bands back into it after going through that sort of broke country phase that you were talking about? Like there's guys like you, there's Midland, you know, obviously Stapleton is doesn't really get played on mainstream country, but you know what I mean? He's there. Or even a guy like Luke Combs, you know, has a little bit more of that sound in there.
I think it's more open than it ever has been. And I think it's definitely needs to be, you know, written for radio, but can sound more of the traditional world if it's written for radio.
Okay. Drill down on that. What is, for people listening who may be young songwriters out there, like what is writing for the radio?
I'd say a good example would be to listen to pop music, some of the pop writers, and see how they, and I think Ed Sheeran's a great writer. It's almost, you could take some of his songs and make them a traditional song if you knew how traditional country works. And there's pop melodies. There's maybe you have a more popular melody with like, you know, a Head Over Boots kind of swing thing. That's a kind of, you know, even a Heartache Medication, it's got a real fast kind of, here I go again, I'm drinking one, I'm using, here I go again, I'm drinking one. You can do it any kind of way that you want to.
Right.
And it's, but now I put fiddle on that thing, man. Like it. So, and not saying you have to listen to pop, but it's just got to be really energetic. And this is just for me as an artist. That's what I'm
wanting. Right.
Because for most, you know, most thing for radio these days is it's a good time. Everybody wants a good time song. Be played on the radio, be uplifting, especially with as much as stuff that we got going on in the world. It is a good time. But and then there's the songs that, and that's what a great song, you know, you put like Stapleton getting on with See My Share of Broken Halos, like that played on the radio. And then it's just that it's coming back, you know. It doesn't have to be all good time, but it's still like you got to get there, get your foot in the door with some good time and stuff. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't have to be about drinking beer. I mean, you can always write about love songs, you know, or moving on songs can be fun and just kind of keep that classic themes. And then I always find that one rare one that gets on the radio. And I think, you know, I was really proud of She Ain't In It being played. It got the 20, but that was a stone cold country, man. And that's my point of like having Head Over Boots, having Heartache on Dance Floor, Dirt My Boots. Boom, here's She Ain't In It. This is the last thing that you would think you're going to have as your single. But some say it was a failure. I think it opened doors. I think it made a little more open for guys like Midland to get some songs on the radio or just like that sound. Because a lot of people miss that kind of stuff.
Sure, sure.
So, I mean, it's hard to talk about country radio and what it is, what it ain't, and what you should do, what's going to work, because you never know. And I feel like songwriters, you should never know if a song is going to work. Because that's not manufactured. When I say write for radio, don't go write all the way radio. Like, we still need different things.
Right, right. But there is that thing that happens when you're writing a song where, like, you know, where it when it does something to you, when it does that magic little thing to you, you're like, yeah, I don't know. It's just a feeling. It's just like if it works on you, maybe it'll work on some other people too. No guarantee.
No,
maybe.
Never know. You know, like I said, you always got to have it. It's going to work. I love it. Yeah. I love it. And I feel like if you feel good, and even when I'm writing these melodies and I don't have a song idea, I don't have lyrics, but I got this kick-ass feel-good melody and I'll say ooh la la dee dee dong dong la, you know, just weird lyrics that don't make any sense, but it sounds awesome. There's something special in that. And I've gotten a lot of songs like that, just I call them dummy lyrics, but it's got the soul. And there's so much aspects of songwriting, but you know, that's why I said, you know, Ed Sheeran's a great example, because he's gotten all kind. Now he's got country cuts, you know, he's writing when he wrote with Thomas Rhett. Thomas said he was a great writer. And so it's just like, I think us popular music, we look up to that too, because we need an outlet and it's fun. And that's why I think it's so much diverse. There's just more diversity in country music, because now there's one instrument that we have never had in country music, and that is a computer.
Right.
More than ever. I think now the computer, the track guy, it is a staple in Nashville. Every publishing company in Nashville on Music Row has a track guy that can do track to help artists that don't necessarily want to learn. They just want, you know, I just need a guitar. Which is great, but that's a new thing. It's
right.
And I think it's more than ever. I mean, for me, it's like that's the new evolution of country music.
I think it's fascinating when the traditional and the modern bang up against each other. That's when you get some sparks.
Oh yeah, it's great, and it's always. I think that's magic, you know. And I think it's a respect for both worlds too at the same time, because. Right. The last thing you want to do is go in guns blazing, you know, raising all kinds of hell with the people you're going to do festivals with and saying that ain't country. It's like, I've always been open, you know, my friends, Thomas, you know, FGL. There's so many, we're all buddies and we're all love playing music. And the last thing you need to do is be like, what ain't country, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I would say this about playing music. So I'm still playing music. I'm still a super fan of everybody that that's living the dream. And if I really like your songs, I'm going to tell you about it. And I like how you did this and being a champion for everybody just getting out and you know, having a record deal. I mean, it gets to the point, like, let's remember, like we're living it, you know? And
well, it's funny, you know, what you just said is so true, man. It's like, you really got to watch who you talk shit about, because eventually you're going to run into them in the catering tent at a festival. No doubt.
Awkward.
I tell you, hey,
yeah, see, you know, and I never, you know, wanted to, I just feel like whatever's working, you know, and a lot of times those guys are stepping out as the same way as I'm stepping out, making a really traditional country song to put the radio. At the same time, they're making a really kind of poppier sound, and they don't know if it's going to work, and some of it doesn't, you know. So it's like I said, that never know is, it's still, you don't ever really know if a song's just, oh, it's going to be great, you know.
Yeah.
It comes both sides of two country and two pop or two rock and roll. There's a lot of stuff.
Well, awesome, man. Dude, I really appreciate you doing this day, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, dude. Anytime, man, whenever we get out of lockdown and we can go hang out, man, I'd love to sit down and just talk some more face-to-face.
For sure. Absolutely, yeah. From 6 feet away, but, you know, face-to-face.
6 feet away, washing hands.
Yeah, I'd love to catch you live sometime, man. Let me know when you're back out on the West Coast tour, and I'd love to come see you live.
As soon as possible, I will make it out.
Nice.
That was John Party on Walking the Floor. Make sure you tune in next week, not 2 weeks from now, but next week, because I'll be putting up another fresh new episode and then trying to do it once a week for as long as I can possibly manage until I get caught up on this backlog of fantastic interviews. And I think the next one I'm putting up is going to be Mr. Pat Green from Texas. You love him, Pat Green. Okay, that's it for this week. Adios, amigos!